I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss the latest research on Alzheimer's disease and some innovative programs being offered here on Cape Cod. Every 66 seconds, someone in America develops Alzheimer's disease. According to the Alzheimer's Association, 5.5 million Americans are living with this disease, which steals memories and changes personalities. By 2050, that number could be as high as 16 million. Joining us on the phone is Dr. Rudy Tanzi, the Joseph and Rose Kennedy Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School and the Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at Mass General. He's also the chair of the Research Consortium at the Cure Alzheimer's Fund. Good morning, Rudy.
Good morning, Mindy. How are you?
Good.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, let's start with the Cure Alzheimer's from that consortium. Tell us about the consortium and the work that's being done.
Well, Cure Alzheimer's Fund is now just over a decade old, and it has become the most powerful and impactful research foundation for Alzheimer's really in the world, mainly because the projects that are funded are of the highest impact. So we've basically recruited the very top scientists around the world who are working on Alzheimer's disease, and we very carefully pick the projects to make sure that they are on point, that they will actually get to the greatest discoveries that will lead to prevention and treatment of this disease. And as a result, just 10 years or so after starting, if you look at the publications, the papers of the research that we've funded, it is in the highest scientific journals and has really already caused several shifts in thinking and paradigms in the field. So I couldn't be more thrilled to serve as a chair for their research consortium and seeing the difference that they're making in the world in approaching this disease.
Yeah, and I think people would be surprised when we look at how much the government spends on funding for research versus private money going to that.
Yeah, the government recently upped the amount. I mean, the government was very low on Alzheimer's research for a while. It was down around under half a billion. And recently, thanks to efforts that began in the Obama administration toward the end of his term, it's gone up over a billion per year now for Alzheimer's funding. But that money is spread over very different types of projects, not just research, but also as needed, reaching out to families, helping families, clinical studies. So in Cure Alzheimer's Fund, all of the funds, and they give out somewhere between, they've been giving out somewhere between 10 and 13 million, I think 12 million a year. But what's interesting is that they don't take anything out. So when you give a dollar to Cure Alzheimer's Fund, just about a whole dollar goes back out to research. Mm-hmm. So, some foundations might give out a percentage of that. So, So that 12 or 13 million that goes out is very carefully targeted toward the highest impact projects that matter right now. And so that's why when you look at the top scientific journals like Science, Nature, Cell, that's where a lot of the papers describing the Cure Alzheimer's Fund research appear, because they tend to be really the top level state-of-the-art studies that are changing the field. Mm. So lots of credit to this local organization. Love working with them. And I'm just amazed at the impact one foundation with that budget can do in so short a time. We've changed the thinking around this disease in so many different ways over the years by just targeting the right projects and getting the right people.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about some of that. Your lab has been working to identify all the genes involved in Alzheimer's, the whole gene sequencing project. Explain how the genes are related to the disease.
Sure. So back when I was a student at Harvard in the 80s, mid-80s, I discovered the first Alzheimer's gene, which makes the plaques. In Alzheimer's mm-hmm. disease in the brain, you get plaques that accumulate outside the nerve cells, and they're like these big boulders. And when they interact with the nerve cells, they cause damage, and the nerve cells start to make the tangles and start to die. Well, so the big question was, what's making the plaque? And people didn't really know. Some said it's just a bunch of junk. It's not just one thing. And there was one scientist who's now since passed. His name is George Glenner in San Diego, who said it's made of a very specific material called beta amyloid. And I went after the gene that makes that and was successful. That was my doctoral thesis. And we named it the amyloid precursor protein, because it's the precursor of the amyloid in the plaques. The amyloid is the sticky material. That gene is still the number one drug target in Alzheimer's disease now 30, 40 years later. because if you stop the plaques, you stop the disease process. And onward we went, you know, finding other genes, and other labs found genes. And most recently, Cure Alzheimer's Fund, the foundation here in Mass, funded at the very beginning of Cure Alzheimer's Fund, 10 years ago, over 10 years ago, funded the Alzheimer's Genome Project, which I direct. And this has led to the generation of a petabyte. A petabyte is 1,000 terabytes. We have a petabyte of genetic data on Alzheimer's, the largest database in the world, not just our own data, but data from around the world. And we have found dozens of Alzheimer's genes now. And they are telling us what genes are involved in different parts of the disease, whether it's the plaques, the tangles, the inflammation in the brain. And once you have genes, you have drug targets. Mm-hmm. So you know, in order to develop a good drug or even a lifestyle intervention, you need to have a target. And the genes give us that. And mm-hmm. we're working on those. So the idea is to go from genes to therapy. So we call that G2T, genes to therapy, and that's the big project we're working on right now.
Yeah. So what we see in Alzheimer's patients is this buildup of these proteins in the brain that you're saying, the beta amyloid plaques and the tau tangles. But what's really interesting is the role that inflammation plays. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was a lot of confusion for decades about whether plaques caused the disease or tangles or both. And the reason was we were using mice. And it turns out mice are just not good models for the human brain. And the big breakthrough came when Cure Alzheimer's Fund, funded my colleague in my lab at our unit, Doo-Yeon Kim, a very talented scientist, and he developed, together with my lab, what we call Alzheimer's in a dish, where we take human stem cells, turn those into nerve cells, and the trick is to grow them in a gel-like material that mimics the brain, because your brain is like Jell-O. And, you know, normally people grow cells in liquid. Well, the brain's not made of liquid. So we do this in this gel, and we call it 3D cell culture because it's three-dimensional. And when you do that, the nerve cells, these human nerve cells, get together and they make networks and they talk to each other and they create connections with each other called synapses. And then we introduce the Alzheimer's genes, including those first two that we found way back in the 80s and 90s, and you have those nerve cells make the amyloid plaques in the dish. And then once that happens, you see the tangles. And so we could see for the first time the proof of concept just over the last couple of years. And again, Cure Alzheimer's Fund made this possible. This was a high-risk, potentially high-benefit, big-benefit project. And we could see that the plaques caused the tangles. And that wasn't possible in the mice. So now we like to think of it this way. The plaques are like the match that you light, and the tangles are like the little brush fires. And these brush fires are killing pockets of nerve cells here and there. And you can also get tangles with bangs to the head. If you have a lot of concussions or bangs to the head, that can cause tangles without the need for the plaques. Mm-hmm. So the plaques take the place of the bangs to the head, so to speak. Now, once these little tangle brush fires occur, it turns out, we've learned, that you can live with a lot of them. You can live just fine with a brain with a lot of plaques and tangles. It's not until the brain reacts to those plaques and tangles. Remember this, the plaques, the tangles are killing the nerve cells. The brain has its own primitive immune system. When it sees these plaques and these tangles and nerve cells dying, there's inflammation. And it's inflammation that basically creates the forest fire. So the plaque is the match, the tangle is the brush fire. You can live with a lot of that, but the forest fire takes you out. That's inflammation, or more specifically, we call it neuroinflammation because it's in the brain. So tackling that has become very big, because if you can stop neuroinflammation in the brain with one set of drugs, you can hit Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, all of them, because they all share this neuroinflammation as the big step that really drives the symptoms, whether it's memory loss or movement disorder, et cetera. And for targeting the neuroinflammation, again, Cure Alzheimer's Fund, with their Alzheimer's Genome Project, made possible the discovery of the key gene that controls the inflammation. Back in 2008, we discovered this gene with a project called CD33, and it turns out to be the on-off switch for neuroinflammation. So now, since then, we've been targeting everything from drugs to even bioelectronic therapies to all types of different therapies to try to hit that gene and turn off the neuroinflammation. And if we can do that, we believe we can stave off this disease, you know, well to past 100 or 110 years old, because the plaques and tangles, like I said, you can tolerate a lot of them. It's the inflammation that takes you out. So this is a big project now to stop that inflammation.
That's huge. And now, if you were to be able to develop a drug or some sort of treatment that could stop the inflammation, what about somebody who is already maybe in mid to advanced stages of Alzheimer's? If you gave it to them at that point, what would happen? They probably wouldn't get back their old memories, but they could make new ones. Is that how it would work?
I have to say, doing the interview with you, Mindy, is so easy because you ask exactly the right questions, and we didn't plan this out. So it turns out, here's how it works. There, many trials have failed on Alzheimer's, right? I'm sure some listeners are saying, hey, if this sounds so great, why are all the trials failing?
Right.
Well, the majority of trials have hit the plaques, and the majority of trials have tried to treat full-blown patients with Alzheimer's disease by stopping the plaques. Well, now we know that the amyloid plaques start to occur 10 to 20 years before the symptoms. And if you hit them when a patient has full-blown Alzheimer's disease, it's too late. The plaques have already peaked and started to plateau. The plaques are going up in number, and then they start to kind of just plateau off. That's when you have full-blown Alzheimer's, because remember, the plaques are like the match. Mm-hmm. So if you think about these trials that failed, you have a forest fire, and you're trying to put it out by blowing out the match. And that's why a lot of these trials failed. And now companies are trying to hit the plaques before symptoms, because this disease begins 10 or 20 years before symptoms. We don't diagnose Alzheimer's disease until there are symptoms. But imagine if we did that in cancer. Imagine if we said, you don't have cancer until you have organ failure with a 2-inch tumor. Mm. Now we're going to treat you. And that's the problem with Alzheimer's. We would never do that with heart disease or diabetes and cancer. You see the disease years before symptoms, and you stop it before there are problems. And Alzheimer's, we wait until the brain goes downhill and there's dementia, and we say, okay, now you have Alzheimer's. Well, the fact is, Alzheimer's begins with the pathology 10, 20 years before with these plaques. So if you want to stop the disease early, you hit the plaques at that time. You can hit the tangles at that time, using that, you know, match and brush fire analogy. But for patients who have the disease right now, patients who have dementia right now, neuroinflammation is the main target. That forest fire is blazing, and you have to put it out. Mm. So I believe that in the future, we'll stop the disease early, before symptoms, by hitting the plaques and tangles. But right now, to help these, you know, 5 or 6 million patients in this country and, you know, over at least 15 million and worldwide, you need to stop the neuroinflammation. And that's where, luckily, we have now over a dozen different Alzheimer's genes, all of which are informing us about how neuroinflammation occurs in the brain. Many of these were found by the Cure Alzheimer's Fund, Alzheimer's Genome Project, including the first one, CD33. And so I'm optimistic that now, by taking an all-out assault, drugs, electromagnetic, bioelectronic, all types of different attempts to stop the neuroinflammation by knowing which genes are involved in targeting those genes and using those genes together with the Alzheimer's in a dish model to recreate the disease. And as you say, we can recreate the entire disease process that takes decades in just 6 to 8 weeks in a dish and then test out all these different therapies. And again, this was a Cure Alzheimer's Fund project.
We're talking about Alzheimer's disease with Dr. Rudy Tanzi. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about Alzheimer's disease with world-renowned Alzheimer's researcher Dr. Rudy Tanzi. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Another area that you're working on is the number of women with Alzheimer's. Of the 5.5 million Americans with Alzheimer's, two-thirds are women. Do we have any idea why more women than men get the disease?
We don't have a clear answer on that yet. This is another big focus of the Cure Alzheimer's Fund. And what we do know is if you look across different neurodegenerative or neurological diseases like multiple sclerosis, and compare that to Alzheimer's disease. What they have in common is this neuroinflammation, where the brain's own immune system literally turns against its nerve cells. We call this the innate immune system, because it's not antibodies and T cells and B cells and the things you'd normally think of with an immune system, like in the rest of the body. The brain's immune system is very primitive. It's at the level of like an oyster or a horseshoe crab. Once nerve cells start to die, there are these little cells called microglia, which are normally housekeeping in the brain. You know, during deep sleep, it's when they clean out the brain of the plaque and debris. But when these microglial cells sense that nerve cells are dying, they try to protect the brain, and they become like soldiers. And they literally shoot out oxygen-based bullets, free radicals, as they're called. And these free radicals start killing the nerve cells. They also cause inflammation. And again, inflammation is meant to kind of clear the area out, because they think they assume there's a problem when the nerve cells are dying. So I like to think about Alzheimer's as a auto-innate immune disease, where, yes, the plaques and the tangles, the pathology of the disease gets you there, but it's the neuroinflammation that's caused as an immune response that's causing the issues. Turns out in women, whether it's multiple sclerosis or Alzheimer's, that neuroinflammation is more profound. Mm-hmm. That it seems that the female brain is more susceptible to neuroinflammation than the male brain. And this is even true in other species, going all the way down, even to more primitive oceanic species, that you see the female brain more prone to inflammation. So that's one clue. The second clue is that during menopause, there can be a lack of energy in the brain. There's a dip in estrogen during menopause, and there's energy deficits. And the brain requires energy. I mean, making all those synapses and, you know, running these 100 billion nerve cells and tens of trillions of connections between them, the synapses, takes a lot of energy. So during menopause, that energy dips, and that can also cause issues that lead to cell death and neuroinflammation. So that's another hypothesis. Now, as a geneticist, I just say, well, look, everything we've learned about this disease have mainly come from discovering the genes involved. Let's see if there are genes that distinguish the female from the male inheritance of this disease. So Cure Alzheimer's Fund worked together with Rotary International and put together this grant that my colleagues and I have been working on, where we're trying to find specific genes and gene mutations that are inherited in women versus men that associate with the disease. And to my delight and surprise, we've been very successful pretty quickly. We already found two major new genes in that search that seem to distinguish inheritance of Alzheimer's in men versus women. And we're working up those genes and trying to understand what they do. And we'll hopefully be publishing that information over the next several months.
When we look at the risk factors and reducing those risks, some of that is pretty similar to what is suggested for people worried about their heart health. You say what's bad for the heart is also bad for the brain, and what's good for the heart is good for the brain.
That's true, yeah. In fact, when you think about what causes the pathology in Alzheimer's, I mentioned the plaques that cause the tangles and the inflammation. Banks to the head can also directly cause inflammation and tangles. Well, neurovascular events, strokes, mini strokes. So in other words, if you have bad heart health, cardiovascular problems can lead to stroke and neurovascular problems. And when you have a stroke, it turns out that the damage done by a stroke, even a mini stroke, can also cause those tangles to form. So instead of plaques now, you have stroke causing the tangles. And the tangles are these twisted little pathological lesions that form inside of nerve cells and kill the nerve cells. And as the nerve cells die, there's inflammation, and then the inflammation ramps everything up to really kill a lot more nerve cells. So that's the process. So a lot of the prevention for Alzheimer's disease centers around good cardio health, good heart health, because that will minimize, as you get older, strokes, or even the little mini strokes you never even notice. You know, people can have these TIAs, mini strokes you don't notice. And they can lead to pockets of these tangles in the brain. And the thing about tangles is they don't sit still. When the tangles form and kill nerve cells, they spread. So a nerve cell has a tangle inside. It dies. It can spit that tangle out. That tangle can travel to another nerve cell and infect it and kill another nerve cell. That's why I call them brush fires, because they spread. And when enough of those nerve cells die, as the tangles are spreading and inflammation kicks in, that's when you're in trouble and you slip down that slippery slope into dementia. Yeah. But heart health, protecting your head, these are two very big projects, I mean, that we're working on in terms of how they cause Alzheimer's. When I say we, I mean Cure Alzheimer's Fund, who's funding a major neurovascular project as well, with the leader in the world on that topic, which is Dr. Zvolkovic at USC in California.
So basically,
and also Dr. Holtzman at WashU in St. Louis.
Yeah. So we're talking about exercise, diet. You recommend a Mediterranean diet, right? Stress reduction, get enough sleep. Those are kind of the four things that you would recommend, right?
Yeah, when I wrote the books on this, I wrote the book Superbrain and Super Genes with Deepak Chopra, and we had four categories in those books of what you need to do. I now have expanded that to six categories, and I'm actually going to be talking about this at Faneuil Hall with Deepak Chopra tomorrow at a Hub Week event at Faneuil Hall tomorrow at 5 o'clock, and I introduced the acronym SHIELD. Shield your brain. So protect your brain. Shield. And shield, the S in shield stands for sleep, meaning you need to try to do whatever you can to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep per night. It's during deep sleep that your brain cleans itself of the plaque and debris that triggers this disease. H in shield stands for handle stress. Stress is a killer. Stress can cause cell death in the brain. It can cause inflammation. So, you know, we recommend a meditation practice, a mindfulness practice, learning about these types of things, and just every day, just kind of, you know, just trying not to worry and get too anxious, you know, handle stress, handle expectations of yourself and of others. I stands for interact. We're very social beings, and the brain benefits from interacting with others. In fact, loneliness is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. It's important to stay socially engaged with friends and family, or even like my mom is 84 years old, and you know every day she goes to a senior center in Cranston, Rhode Island, and volunteers, making dolls and doing things for underprivileged children in the area, and that you know gives her social engagement that's so good at that age, and she's as sharp as a tack. Mm-hmm. Now the E in SHIELD stands for exercise. So daily you should aim at trying to get yourself to walk 8 to 10,000 steps. You know, now there are devices that can tell you if you're doing that. Or at least 3 to 4 times per week, try to get a good 20-minute to 30-minute workout. I play basketball. I also, on off days, I swim in the morning. But trying to get workout every day. And during exercise, you actually allow new nerve cells to be born in your brain. And people may say, what? You know, that's not possible. Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, in the short-term memory area of the brain that's affected in Alzheimer's, you can grow new nerve cells. It's a process called neurogenesis, and exercise causes that to happen. Mm. Exercise also causes the plaques to be dissolved, and it also causes the elimination of the inflammation in the brain. So exercise is probably number one. Among all these things. L in SHIELD stands for learn new things, like listening to your show right now, Cindy. Every morning you're helping people stave off Alzheimer's by learning new things. That's L. And the reason why is when you learn new things, you make synapses, connections, and you strengthen connections. And in Alzheimer's disease, it's a game of synapse loss. In other words, if you lose too many of these connections, you have 100 billion nerve cells and tens of trillions, hundreds of trillions of connections, and it's losing those connections that leads to dementia. So you want to make more. I tell people when you're going to retire, don't think just about financial reserve. think about synaptic reserve and cognitive reserve. Learn new things. Stock up on those synapses by learning new things so you can lose more before you have issues. And finally, D. D is diet. And as you mentioned, Mediterranean diet is number one. Less red meat, more fruits and vegetables, nuts, olive oil. Stay away from junk food. Stay away from processed food. Limit sugar and fat. For hypertension purposes, limit salt. If you have hypertension, there's also the DASH, D-A-S-H, DASH diet. Hypertension plays a role in this disease in some cases, so some folks suggest a combination of Mediterranean and DASH diet. You can look up these diets online. And also, I'm working on various natural products and supplements that might help, and that's a whole other topic.
Let's bring in Melanie Braverman. She's the co-founder and cultural director of the Alzheimer's Family Support Center of Cape Cod. Welcome, Melanie. Good to see you.
Thanks.
All right. So tell us first about your organization's mission.
Well, we provide an array of completely free services for families living with Alzheimer's and dementia disease all over the Cape, from the Bridges, Bourne, Falmouth to Provincetown. And that is the mission of the organization, is to provide free services, given that these are very expensive diseases to navigate for families.
Yeah. You have a really unique program, I think. Tell us about this multi-generational chorus. This is bringing some kids together with seniors. Mm-hmm. Tell us about this.
Well, the genesis of the program was that our executive director, Molly Perdue, had been watching these YouTube videos of a group called PS24 in New York. And these were singing groups of kids at this public school, and they're amazing. And she said, we should do something like that. And so we partnered with the East Ham Senior Center has a day program called The Gathering Place. And the music therapist is a lovely young woman named Brianna LePage. And we decided that unlike other vocal music groups that have happened in the country, that we would try and bring people with the disease, caregivers, and school kids together to sing. But we built some things into the program because we're small. We think that everything we do needs to do more than one thing. So we decided that there would be this cultural opportunity and a social opportunity. And I like the shield thing because it looks like we're doing lots of those things. Thank you, Dr. Tansey, with this program. So, you know, understanding that isolation is one of the leading causes of difficulty for people navigating the disease, not just people with the disease, but caregivers as well. So we made this program where we bring these three segments of the community together to sing the middle two Wednesdays a month at the East Ham Senior Center. But we also know that education is a major part of how we're going to move the cause of Alzheimer's forward. So we go into the schools prior to the meetings, and we work with fourth and fifth graders, and we dementia train the kids. So, and this is nothing complicated. We teach them that they need to come around to the front of somebody who has Alzheimer's to be able to talk to them, because people with Alzheimer's are losing their peripheral perception. We tell them that if they're going to give an elder a glass of water, they have to make sure that they get that glass of water off the floor after they have the glass of water, because people with the disease are often losing their depth perception. So falls are more at risk. The teachers love it because it teaches the kids good manners. Mm-hmm. But we know that we are creating a kind of body of knowledge in young kids that defrays the stigma around the disease and helps educate them going forward. So we bring all these people together in the room. But one of the things we love about this program is that we also, not only do the kids learn the music of the elders' generation, but we have the kids teach the elders music from their generation. So there's this incredible cultural exchange that happens as well. And then there's, you know, basic relationship building that happens. Part of Molly's research had to do with understanding that the Americans with Disabilities Act was as applicable, or should be as applicable, to people with Alzheimer's and dementia as it is to any other disability. So we are committed to helping people stay in their community in the least restrictive environment possible, understanding that that might require certain accommodations. So one of the things we do is we make everybody wear name tags. In our chorus program, we have the kids be responsible for the creation of the name tags. So they make their own, and then they have to go around to each elder, ask them their name, ask them the correct spelling of their name, and then make them name tags. So that fosters a kind of relationship building within the context of this small program. It's been so successful that the program has now been written into the curriculum of the Nauset Public Schools. And I just want to give a shout out to the music teacher at Eastham Elementary. Her name is Eileen Poitras, and she's been amazing in understanding how rich this program is and what its potential is, and really has been a great advocate for bringing it into the larger sphere of the curriculum of the school.
And you're going to be bringing it to Yarmouth as well, right?
We are in the process of creating another program in Yarmouth, collaborating with Kathy Bailey at the COA in Yarmouth. We're talking to some people at the Cape Cod Conservatory. So we're trying to kind of spread the word, make it more accessible to people in different parts of the Cape. We're thinking about bringing in older kids rather than younger kids, just to see how many different sectors of the community we can involve.
Yeah. Dr. Tansey, there's a lot of research on music here, right? Music therapy?
Yeah, music's amazing. I'm so glad you brought that up, Melanie. In fact, I even started an app on the iPhone and Android called Spark Memories Radio, where the idea is to spark memories. And it turns out that, you know, in Alzheimer's, the information coming in from the world is being recorded in the brain, but they can't play it back, right? They can't access it. And music is a great backdoor way to stimulate brain regions to start to help to play back memories that are otherwise stuck. And the music that does it best is, and you might have seen this already, is the music that patients grew up with between the ages of 13 and 25. Because it's that music, you know, during high school and college that you really emotionally bond with. That's the music that gets you through some of the most tumultuous times of your life, and, you know, high school, college, first job. And, you know, and that's the music you kind of stick with. You listen to new music, but that's the music that hits you. So we have in the program, you give the birth date of the patient, and then it starts playing hits that were hits when they were 13 to 25, and you can say what genres they like, and it's amazing. The emails we're getting back about how it's calming the patient or it's waking the patient up who's been vegetative is just amazing. But music is incredibly powerful.
And I think, you know, the other thing I want to say about these programs is that there are so many ancillary benefits. So it's also can act as a gateway to getting reluctant people into more services that we provide through the center. There's all kinds of, there's relationship building. We had one kid who had no interest in singing. He could not be less interested in singing, but he was a skateboarder. And it just so happened that one of the couples that came to the group had a grandson who was a fancy skateboard guy in California. And so the next time they came, they remembered to bring signed magazines for this kid. Mm-hmm. And he loved coming to the program. He hated singing. It never changed. But he built a relationship with this couple that had nothing to do with singing. Mm-hmm. So we know that once we get people engaged, many, many good things happen.
Yeah. We have an email from Jesse who says, my grandmother had Alzheimer's. My mother is now 70, and I'm concerned. Although there is no real signs at this point, what is your suggestion? I guess go to the shield? Would that be what you say?
Well, you know, in terms of genetics, the earlier the age of onset in the family, the stronger the role of genetics. So I personally believe all cases of Alzheimer's involve some genetic component, but it goes by age. So the cases that occur at much older ages, the genetics plays, you know, less of a role than lifestyle. And if the disease is hitting early in life, then genetics is playing a major role. So no matter what, if you're in a family where there's Alzheimer's disease and you have a first-degree relative with the disease and your risk is higher, it's shield is no longer just an option, it's an obligation. So you really have to give yourself a kick in the pants and say, I need to do this. I need to try to get 7 to 8 hours of sleep and all the other things in the SHIELD acronym. And, you know, it's just becomes a much more obligatory if you're in a family. Just like if you're in a family with heart disease, you have to exercise more and eat more carefully and check your cholesterol.
Right.
And I would also say that later on, when we have the drugs online that stop the amyloid plaques, you know, if you're in a family with Alzheimer's, when the time comes, you'll want to have your brain imaged to see if there's plaque and get on one of these drugs that hopefully will be online in the next 5 years or so that will stop the amyloid, just like you get on a cholesterol drug when your cholesterol is too high if you're in a family with heart disease.
Yeah. And Phil says, my mother is taking, and I don't know how to say this, D-O-N-E-P-Z-A-I-L.
Donepezil,
okay,
yeah.
But what is the mechanism that that this uses, and how effective is it? Are there methods to decrease the inflammation?
So it doesn't. So Aricept or donepezil, the two, you know, the big drugs are Aricept and Exelon, and they what they do is they preserve the chemical in the brain that's used for learning and memory. It's a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. So these drugs like Aricept and Exelon preserve that so that you get basically more bang for your buck from your nerve cells. You get more of that chemical needed for learning and memory. It doesn't stop the disease process. The nerve cells are still dying. The synapses are being lost. There's still inflammation. It's just trying to get more out of those nerve cells. So that's not good enough, obviously. The other drug, Namenda, also is more treating the symptoms and not treating the actual disease itself. So we don't currently have drugs that are available that stop the disease, just ones that try to ameliorate symptoms. And that's why we're working so hard, because that's just not enough.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about Alzheimer's disease with Dr. Rudy Tanzi, the Joseph and Rose Kennedy Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School, Director of the Genetics and Aging Research Unit at Mass General, and the Chair of the Research Consortium at Cure Alzheimer's Fund, and Melanie Braverman, Co-Founder and Cultural Director of the Alzheimer's Family Support Center of Cape Cod. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Melanie, you had a really interesting photo exhibit when you were talking about this. I thought this was really fascinating. Let our listeners in on it.
Well, you know, so part of what we do to pay for our services is obviously we have fundraisers. And we have had the great gift of being given the facility at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown over Labor Day every year. So we try and come up with different ways to raise money at these shows, knowing that, again, we want it, what we do to do more than one thing. So we came up with this idea to do a photo exhibit. And what we did was we invited professional photographers to submit images, but we also solicited work by people with the disease. The mandate was only that people take pictures. They didn't need to have experience having taken pictures. And then we had those photographs printed, and we hung them equally in the exhibit with the work by professional photographers. So unless you knew the photographers, you wouldn't know whose was whose. And it was really quite an amazing experience. We had Greg O'Brien, who's a friend of all of ours, had a beautiful series of photographs. We didn't really try and dictate content at all. We had one person that is part of our community who has Lewy body dementia, and he has a lot of hallucinations. And he's quite frank about describing them. There are geometrical orbs, and they float through the air, and they go through the walls, et cetera. And he talks a lot about them. And I said, well, do you think you could show us what they look like? And he said, well, how would I do that? They're in my head. And I said, well, maybe you could figure out how to stage them and photograph them. So he and his wife and his daughter figured out how to stage these photographs. And his wife, God bless her, she's a rule follower, and she didn't think Photoshop was allowed. So they actually worked really hard to create these images of his hallucinations. And they're amazing photographs. They're really beautiful. And they're also, according to him, very accurate to what he sees. And now we have him writing about them. And we've decided to make a book of these photographs and of his writing about the phenomena of the hallucinations, et cetera. And So these are the kinds of things that... So what did the show do? It raised us some money. It educated the community about the phenomena of the disease. It empowered the people with the disease to get out in front of it. And we had a big party, so there was a big social piece of it. So it was a really lovely experience. And this is what we're trying to do with all of these events, is to try and educate, reduce the isolation for people with the disease and caregivers, keep them topical to AD and dementia, but also, and most importantly, I think, to accommodate people so that whoever wants to come is able to join us. So that means what? We wear name tags, yes, but we also make sure people have transportation and that they have parking and that we have enough trained volunteers at the events that caregivers don't have to worry about the well-being of the people that they bring with them. We keep the noise down. So it's that kind of thing that we try and fold into all of these events.
Yeah. One of the things I'm wondering, Dr. Tansey, as we're hearing this, this description of what's happening in your brain, one thing we haven't talked about is the anger and depression, that paranoia that's associated with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. What's happening in the brain that causes this?
Well, I'll try to keep the answer short because it's a long answer. But basically, every day when you're taking in information, people are hearing your voice right now. They're hearing me. They're looking around the room, seeing what they see. Your senses are bringing in information. We take for granted that we put that information into context, right? If you see a stereo speaker, you know that that's for playing music. An infant wouldn't know that. If you lose those synapses, those connections between the nerve cells that allow you to make sense of things, like I see a car and I know that's for driving and getting somewhere, or I see a speaker and I know that's for hearing sound, you can't put your world into context. And little by little, this is what's eroded in the Alzheimer's brain, is putting sensory information about your world into context with what you already know about the world, everything you've experienced and learned since you were an infant or in the womb. And over time, losing that context takes you out of time and space. It steals your personality. It steals your sense of self, of you and the world and how you relate to the world from yourself. And that takes its toll. That leads to frustration. It leads to anger. It leads to paranoia when you suddenly don't know how to make sense of your world. And it's a progressive set of symptoms. And it occurs early in the disease with anger and frustration, depression, even not being able to recall words or names or being able to lift that fog that's mysteriously removing yourself from yourself. All these things can be terrifying and also causing agitation, depression, and eventually paranoia. Mm. So that's why this disease is just so terrible. It robs oneself of their self.
Yeah. Melanie, you have a walk coming up on Sunday.
And, we do.
And I love how you're making it so everybody can be included. You've got a trolley for some of the folks who may not be able to do the walk.
Absolutely.
Tell us about the walk.
Well, so we do it's our biggest fundraiser of the year right now. It happens in Provincetown, land of all fun events. And we make these events, again, do more than one thing. And part of what we do is we make them into enormous community celebrations. So we want to make it possible for anybody to come. Last year we had, infants in strollers, and we had very old people and people with the disease. So we, the Mayflower Trolley has been very generous, and they donate their trolley. And we put people with the disease and Brianna, who's a music therapist, on the trolley, and they ride the route so that they can still participate. We, at the end of the walk, everybody comes into town hall and we feed everybody and we have live music and there's dancing. It's a really, really fun event. This year, we also have Mayflower Trolley driving people from Brewster. We have a hub in Brewster where we're going to bring people because, a lot of older couples don't want to drive, and it builds the community. So they're also talking to each other on the trolley, et cetera, et cetera. So we would love to have you come. It's a very short walk. It goes from Town Hall in Provincetown to the West End Breakwater and back. So it's just under 2-mile walk. it's more about community than anything. You can call us at 508-896-5170 for more information, or go to our website, which is AlzheimersCapeCod.org. We like to tell people that you don't have to walk to give, and you don't have to give to walk.
Yeah, and we'll have to put a link up on our website.
Excellent.
As well. And Dr. Tanzi, Cure Alzheimer's Fund has their annual symposium coming up on October 19th in Boston. It is open to the public, but you do have to register ahead of time, and we'll have a link to that at our website, capeandislands.org. But the focus there is the role of infection. Anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, this is new, and this is another example of Cure Alzheimer's Fund as a foundation, you know, funding a totally new idea that is now really on fire, and that is the idea that low-grade infections, infections in the brain due to viruses like herpes, also bacterial infections, ones that don't cause clinical symptoms because, you know, they're low-grade, but they could trigger plaques. So it turns out what we've learned is that plaques protect the brain. So the plaques are not just junk. The plaques that begin this disease are forming in the brain to protect the brain against low-grade infections due to viruses, bacteria, even yeast. And so we're going to talk all about that process, that plaques mean to do well to protect the brain, but in the end, they cause Alzheimer's disease. So that will be the topic, and I'll be presenting with my colleague who really is the champion of that new hypothesis. His name is Rob Moyer, who's a member of our unit at Mass General.
And we have an email from Ruth, says, I'm interested in knowing if there's a difference between vascular dementia and Alzheimer's.
Yeah, vascular dementia is the dementia that comes from things like stroke or mini-stroke events. But eventually the damage that's caused by vascular dementia can lead to Alzheimer's disease pathology. So you often see mixed vascular dementia and Alzheimer's together. But specifically, vascular dementia is the type that begins with things like stroke.
Yeah, and Dr. Hens, your hope is to prevent Alzheimer's for the younger generation, and as we've been talking about, also treat the people who need it now. And you know, we've been talking about this for many years now. But I know you've been optimistic all along. I'm guessing that you're even more optimistic than you were maybe 5 years ago.
I'm optimistic because I feel like we finally have some clarity on what's happening. You know, and I can't emphasize enough how Cure Alzheimer's Fund has made the difference with the projects they funded that brought us to clarity about the order of events, that the plaques are causing the tangles, and then these two things cause the cell death and the inflammation. And now that we have a good idea of not just the players, but the play itself, now we not only will develop the right drugs, but use them at the right time, because that's been the mistake in the past, is we were using good drugs at the wrong time. You know, like trying to stop plaques in a full-blown Alzheimer's patient where the plaques did their job 10 years ago. You had to do that 10 years ago. And now we know that in patients who have full symptoms, we have to develop ways to stop the neuroinflammation. And now we have the genes to do that. So just having that clarity of vision allows us to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and I'm more optimistic than ever.
Okay, real quick, Melanie.
I just want to say that one of the ways that the Alzheimer's Family Support Center really dovetails with what Dr. Tanzi is doing is that we know that until there's a cure, there are a lot of people who need help.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to say that if there's anybody who's listening who needs any kind of help in navigating these diseases, they should call us, 508-896-5170. Someone will pick up the phone, and we'll get help to you as soon as we can.
And again, we will have links to the Alzheimer's Family Support Center of Cape Cod. We'll also have a link for more information about the Cure Alzheimer's Fund and the symposium coming up on October 19th. Melanie Braverman, Dr. Rudy Tanzi, thank you both so much for being here and for the work that you do.
Thanks, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.